Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, just about to celebrate, no, commemorate, no, observe, no, ignore. Congratulations to the wonderful people of Afghanistan. You know, it looked like an election. Evidence indicates it might not really have been one, but it looked like one, you know, on TV. And ladies and gentlemen, the good news is that despite all this, these reports of warming that I share with you, among other places, you get these on a regular basis. But the good news is soon come, in geological terms, a new ice age. The bad news? Don't be burying your nuclear waste anywhere in particular right now. A research project is underway in Greenland, examining the impact of glaciers on bedrock, according to this report. The international project is being funded by nuclear power companies that are planning the final storage of radioactive wastes, hundreds of meters, look it up, below the Earth's surface. The Finnish sponsor of the project is a company called Posiva Oy. I was waiting for the West Side reading of that, which is beginning construction work on an underground nuclear waste repository in 2020 at a community in Finland called Olkiluoto. The final waste storage facility is to be designed to withstand the challenges posed by nature for the next 100,000 years. Good luck with that. What did we withstand over the last 100,000 years? Hands? Why don't we build them inside pyramids? The final waste storage facility, yeah, okay. Experts predict the next ice age may start in Finland in about 6,000 years. So if you can just hang on through the warming, 6,000 years from now, you'd get to chill. The Geological Survey of Finland, GTK, don't ask me, is also taking part in the core sampling being carried out in Greenland. Researchers are coordinating a group that is examining the effects of meltwater from glaciers on the bedrock. We're in the right place, and the corings have been a success. Now we're awaiting the first results with interest, says one of the experimenters. The permafrost probably goes deeper than assumed or has previously been imagined. This is crucial information needed for planning further research. That's how close we are. The former director of research for the Geological Survey of Finland, Professor Matti Saarnisto, has been highly critical of the final disposal facility for spent nuclear fuel planned for Finland. He says that planners have underestimated the impact of the permafrost that will penetrate deep into the earth. Permafrost, he says, will cause massive variations in pressure around the nuclear waste repository, and that contains the seeds of disaster, according to Saarnisto. But they're just seeds. They might not germinate. They might not, you know, have birds to pick them up and carry them. Professor Saarnisto points out it is impossible to make predictions 100,000 years into the future. Well, thank God he pointed that out. Man, I've been assuming it was cool. It was easy. You know, I was going to go to the track 100,000 years from now and bet on. He says important data was ignored in the planning report for the facility. The matter of fact is that to some extent, all the research institutes involved are suffering from a hostage syndrome, he says. They see it as essential that spent fuel be disposed of at Olkiluoto because it has been planned that way for decades. There is no scientific basis for it, he says. Says the company's research director, Juhani Vera, we want to show, this is why they're funding the research, we want to show that even though the permafrost goes deep, as the results from our models indicate, it will not pose any threat to the safety of the final disposal facility. So he knows the conclusion he wants to reach when he funds the research. That's good science, kids. So far, final disposal of highly radioactive spent fuel from nuclear plants has not been carried out anywhere in the world. But the world, you know, it's, geez, a lot of planets. There might be some planet where it's being carried out. Says Tino Ruskinimi, of the Geological Survey of Finland, the necessary studies still have to be completed. That is why the issue is being examined. Is there something related to an ice age, something that should possibly be taken into consideration in the construction or location of a final disposal facility? We don't know yet. It's impossible to react to claims at this point. Clean, safe, cheap, too safe to, too place to meet from nuclear power. Ladies and gentlemen, we just, you know, who knows? And the wave of reports to this broadcast on the switch, digital switchover, the wave has crested and subsided, both the good news and the bad news. Maybe that means people are adjusting. Maybe that means things are good. Maybe that means people have gotten tired. But this report from NewJersey.com, living just 3 miles from New Jersey Network, that's the public television network in New Jersey, the broadcast tower. John Dorsey thought he would have superior over-the-air digital television reception, but in the 2 months since the digital switch, Dorsey hasn't been able to watch any public television programs on his upstairs bedroom TV, not even a blip, he says. Frustrated, he called New Jersey Public Television and learned that despite his proximity to the tower, the station's transmissions were being beamed over his house. The reason: the university and its transmission tower sit on a 400-foot hill overlooking and overshooting many household antennas. I was told, he says, the only way I could solve this is if I put a 50-foot antenna over my house. And obviously, I'm not going to do that. Oh, come on. For Antiques Roadshow? You're not going to... The bulk of continuing digital television reception problems seem to be occurring in rural areas of New Jersey. Many residents from densely populated areas are also complaining. The digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. But that's New Jersey. And I have to say, as a New Orleanian, the politicians here are hanging their heads in shame. Yes, Bill Jefferson was convicted, and his brother Mose was convicted of federal corruption charges. But neither of them nor any of the other politicians here had thought of a scam involving black market kidneys like the ones in New Jersey. They should be ashamed. Hello, welcome to the show. Well, I tried to run my game. She said, man, that's the same old thing I've heard before. And I'm too tired to go by your show. Back and bend like a monkey. From the edge of America. No. From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana. You know, stuff just comes out of my mouth. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And that happened because I was thinking about this, which, you know, it's taken some people some time to figure out what's going on with the new federal administration in New Orleans. But in today's New Orleans Times-Picayune, there's an exclusive interview with President Barack Obama, which means that at the White House, at least the calendars work, because we are coming up on the fourth anniversary of the flooding of New Orleans. Now, the president does say he won't be in New Orleans for the anniversary. He says in the interview, I'll be there by the end of the year. And I'm sure he'll say that to New York on September 11th. I'll be there before the end of the year. But, you know, those appearances we know are photo ops anyway. George Bush made three of them on Katrina anniversaries. So, no problem. Take the vacation, babe. Relax, chill. But in the interview, a couple things that basically send a pretty powerful message. One is that he was asked, was President Obama, about the fate of the Gulf Coast Recovery Czar. I don't know if you remember that President Bush, ex-President Bush, named a Dallas banker, I believe, to the role of Gulf Coast Recovery Czar, who was supposed to coordinate the efforts of the federal government in this area. And when President Obama came in, he named a successor to fill that post. The post ceases to exist at the end of September, and he was asked, well, are you going to move to extend it? And he said, well, you know, I'm not into boxes on organizational charts, meaning, no, I'm not. Then there's, and those of you who've listened, and God bless you if you have, I know it's been rough sledding, but it's been rough sledding. The broadcasts with Dr. Bob Bee, who ran one of the engineering investigations into the Katrina disaster, and Dr. Ivor van Heerden, who ran one of the others. You're familiar with the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. It's the notorious channel from the Gulf to the heart of New Orleans that people warned for decades would serve the function in conditions of high storm surge of funneling the surge into the heart of the city, which it did on August 29th, 2005. And so, as we read the story or listened to the tape of the interview that the president did with the New Orleans Times-Picayune, my interest was piqued as he was ticking off items of progress in New Orleans since the Obama administration came into office by how thoroughly he'd studied up.
We've already closed the Mississippi River Gulf
Outlet.
The Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. That's part of, I think, a broader process of thinking through how do we use natural barriers as part of the protection process.
Yeah, it's part of that. It's part of remembering what the name of the thing is that destroyed half the city. That's what it's part of. The Mississippi River Gulf. The thing where the thing happened to the place. Thanks, babe. And then in summation of the interview, of the 10 minutes that he devoted to this subject, there was this.
Why should the rest of the country still care about rebuilding issues 4 years after the hurricane?
You know, I think that, Katrina was really a wake-up call for the country about our need to fulfill our commitments to our fellow citizens, a recognition that there but the grace of God go I, that all of us can fall prey to these kinds of natural disasters.
Yeah, if it was a wake-up call, were still asleep because it wasn't a natural disaster. Dr. Bob B., interviewed on this program, co-head of the ILIT survey published by UC Berkeley, says, quote, Katrina, the flooding of New Orleans specifically, was, quote, the largest man-made engineering catastrophe since Chernobyl, end quote. So answer the wake-up call, sir. Thank you very much. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Energy Department strives to be a leader in championing energy efficiency. Its website lists energy-saving tips. Secretary Stephen Chu calls conservation one of the department's most important goals. But at many of the agency's buildings, even at national laboratories where talented scientists seek technological breakthroughs to save energy, the department has failed to use one of the most effective tools available to any ordinary household. Thermostats that automatically dial back the temperature when nobody is around. A recent audit by the Energy Department's Inspector General found the department could save more than $11.5 million annually in energy costs by properly employing these controls to adjust the heat and air conditioning at night and weekends. I know, hard to believe, and yet easy to believe. The Energy Department's IG found that the department, which spends almost $300 million annually on utilities, could save enough energy to power more than 9,800 homes each year by doing what experts say every household in the country should also be doing, and many already are. The payback would far exceed the cost. In some cases, the equipment has already been installed but is not working. Kathy Zoe, an assistant energy secretary, said the department took the audit's findings seriously and that the report could give the agency, quote, the impetus to show that efficiency really is a high priority. Unquote. Some call it the impetus of love. If this can help us galvanize attention, then it's fantastic, Ms. Zoe said. The inspector general reviewed 55 buildings at four department sites for the audit, finding that the agency had either not used or not suitably maintained thermostat settings at 35, more than half of those buildings. They can be used in most buildings, but should be avoided in buildings that contain items sensitive to temperature change or that are used for long hours. The Energy Department runs a variety of programs relating to energy production and conservation and is in charge of the nuclear weapons production complex. The thermostats were neglected across the board. In the report, some department officials implied that financing issues could have contributed to the thermostat setbacks not being used, while others said there was simply not a priority. For its part, the Inspector General's office said it could find no plausible reason for the lack of interest. Quote, we could not obtain what we considered to be a satisfactory explanation as to why the department failed to take advantage of this conservation practice, the report said, one that is generally low cost and has limited, if any, adverse impact on operations or building occupants. News. Ms. Zoe said the department was looking at steps to increase efficiency in its buildings, including offering more support to the facility managers who oversee efficiency measures. They've got a lot of responsibility, so we want to give them the help that they need to maximize efficiency, she said. They need help. Help them, someone, won't you? Please give. News of Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now the award-winning News of the Warm.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. Oh, pardon me. The thinning of a gigantic glacier in Antarctica is accelerating, scientists now report. The Pine Island Glacier in West Antarctica, which is around twice the size of Scotland, about which more, in a moment, is losing ice four times as fast as it was a decade ago. The research published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters reveals that ice thinning is now occurring much further inland. At this rate, scientists estimate that the main section of the glacier will have disappeared in just 100 years, six times sooner than was previously thought. But what's it going to do in 100,000 years? That's what I want to know. We can predict that, can't we? The Pine Island Glacier is located within the most inaccessible area of Antarctica and was for many years overlooked, much like the guy's house in New Jersey. Now scientists have been able to track the glacier's development using continuous satellite measurements over the past 15 years. There's an app for that, apparently. Accelerated thinning of the Pine Island Glacier represents perhaps the greatest imbalance in the cryosphere today. Did you know there was a cryosphere? And yet we would not have known about it were it not for a succession of satellite instruments, says Professor Andrew Shepard, a co-author of the research. Being able to assemble a continuous record of measurements over the past 15 years has provided us with a remarkable ability to identify both subtle and dramatic changes in ice that were previously hidden. Scientists believe that the retreat of glaciers in this sector of Antarctica is caused by warming of the surrounding oceans, though it is too early to link such a trend to global warming. All right, then. We'll await further developments on that. That's the Antarctic. What's happening in the Arctic? That's called in the business a segue. It's been predicted for years, and now it's happening. Deep in the Arctic Ocean, water warmed by climate change is forcing the release of methane from beneath the sea floor. How does that happen? Who's going to explain it to you? Over 250 plumes of gas have been discovered bubbling up from the seafloor to the west of the Svalbard archipelago, my favorite archipelago, ladies and gentlemen, just in case anybody asks you, which lies north of Norway. The bubbles are mainly methane, which is a greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. The methane is probably coming from reserves of methane hydrate beneath the seabed. These hydrates are water ice with methane molecules embedded in them. That is to say, they've been trapped below the sea until now. The methane plumes were discovered by an expedition aboard a research ship, James Clark Ross, led by Tim Minchell of the United Kingdom. The region where the team found the plumes is being warmed by the West Spitsbergen Current, which is warmed by 1 degree centigrade over the past 30 years. Hydrates are stable only within a particular range of temperatures, says Minchell, so if the ocean warms, some of the hydrates will break down and release their methane. None of the plumes the team saw reached the surface, so the methane was not escaping into the atmosphere, whew, and thus contributing to climate change. Not in that area, at least. Bigger bubbles of methane make it all the way to the top. Smaller ones dissolve, says Minchell. Just because it fails to reach the surface, though, according to New Scientist, doesn't mean the methane is harmless. Some of it gets converted to carbon dioxide. The CO2 then dissolves in seawater and makes the oceans more acidic. We've heard about that before. And it's possible that other more vigorous plumes are releasing methane directly into the atmosphere. The team have, after all, studied only one group of plumes in a small area, and they were erratic. I know the feeling. Almost none of the Arctic has been surveyed in a way that might detect a gas release like this, says Minchell. Ronald Cohen of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington says it's a striking result. What's amazing is they see such enormous quantities of methane. Probably in this area studied up to 27 kilotons, 60 million pounds a year, which suggests that the entire hydrate deposit around the area could be releasing 20 megatons a year. 20 megatons! If methane began escaping at similar rates throughout the Arctic, it would dramatically increase methane levels in the atmosphere. And that's not good for the atmosphere. Stormwater flowing off rain gutters, sidewalks, and roadways. Now, these are people who are trying to fix the problem. You will find this perhaps hard to believe. Stormwater flowing off rain gutters, sidewalks, and roadways may be California's new liquid gold, as Californians face shrinking water supplies due to rising temperature. This according to a new report reported in the Contra Costa Times. In western states, there's been an increasing push to see this as a water supply resource, says the co-author of the report, Noah Garrison. He teamed with UC Santa Barbara and University of Washington researchers to release an analysis of how rainwater capture or infiltration projects could make up for water shortages attributed to altered weather. Yes, in Los Angeles and other parts of California, rainwater isn't captured in reservoirs or rain barrels or cisterns or anything. It flows into the gutter, the storm drain, and out to pollute the ocean. Because, you know, there'll be more. By 2050, winters cut short by climate change are expected to reduce by one quarter the snowpack in the Sierra. Stormwater that's usually dumped into the nearest waterway could fill a critical gap in this predicted shortfall, the new report states. Capturing more of this rainwater at residential and commercial sites could net more than 400,000 acre-feet of water a year, enough to supply two-thirds of the water used annually by the city of Los Angeles. If government and industrial sites were added to the equation, the water savings projected for those regions alone would increase by another 75,000 acre-feet annually. Hundreds of thousands more acre-feet of water are likely available if the rest of the state is factored in. Capturing rainwater in cisterns or barrels or diverting it into open fields, rain gardens, or ponds keeps it from entering the stormwater runoff system. If it goes into the ground through ponds, it gets filtered by the microbes in the earth, you see, ladies and gentlemen. More on the subject of methane. Scientists at the University of Calgary have found that methane emission by plants, those damn plants, it's not just the cows, could be a bigger problem in global warming than previously thought. A U of C study says that when crops are exposed to environmental factors that are part of climate change, such as increased temperature, drought, and ultraviolet B radiation, some plants show enhanced methane emissions. Kill them. Just kill them. What are you going to do? Tasmania's east coast is recording its highest ever winter water temperatures, more than 55 degrees Fahrenheit, up 2.5 degrees above normal due to a strengthening of an ocean current originating north of Australia. Satellites have given oceanographers an insight into a remarkable phenomenon, a significant extension of the Lewin Current curling around the southern tip of Tasmania, which means, I guess, the salmon from there won't be as good anymore. Massive burning of forests for agriculture thousands of years ago may have increased atmospheric carbon dioxide enough to alter global climate and usher in a warming trend that continues today, according to a new study that appears in the journal Quaternary Science Reviews. Researchers at UVA and the University of Maryland say today 6 billion people use about 90% less land per person for growing food than was used by far smaller populations early in the development of civilization. Those early societies relied on slash-and-burn techniques to clear large tracts of land for relatively small levels of food production. They had little incentive to maximize yield. There was plenty of forest to burn. Those dumb early humans. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature for this of this broadcast. And Newt Gingrich writes on the website of the American Enterprise Institute. I recently joined up with the Education Secretary and with the Reverend Al Sharpton to push for dramatic reform in our educational system. We've launched a tour that will take us to Atlanta, Baltimore, and New Orleans these next few months. Sadly, 26 years of reform effort have failed to achieve the progress we need. My purpose for joining the Secretary and Reverend Al Sharpton is to bring all of our efforts together to formulate a tripartisan plan for arriving at a breakthrough in education. Wonder what that's going to sound like. We'll find out moments from now here on the show. We'll be right back. City tonight, where I'll be hosting an all-star tribute to cosmetic surgery for the benefit of the Olivia Foundation, which provides elective surgeries for dysmorphic women in third world countries. That's Radio City this coming Wednesday. Tonight, two old friends of Larry King Live back with us to talk about their new partnership. If you think you've seen The Odd Couple, wait till you see these two together. Here in our New York studio, the Reverend Al Sharpton. And in our Washington bureau, the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. Mr. Speaker, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. And I just want to point out to our your viewers that one of the delicious ironies of this partnership is that of the two of us, I'm the one who hasn't run for president.
and I'm the one who hasn't put on weight.
Oh, you've lost weight. You look good.
I feel good, Larry. I feel better than Tawana Brawley on a wedding night.
Mr. Speaker, how did this partnership come about? This wasn't a case of the two of you running into each other at an airport, was it?
That's a good question, Larry.
Because that's how my wife, Sean, first got involved with Jermaine Jackson.
Even better.
Which, of course, they're not anymore.
Got it. What was the question?
Larry, Newt and I are both represented for certain types of speaking appearances by the same agency. And it was a representative of that organization who first suggested that we do a speaking tour together.
Sort of like Timothy Leary and G. Gordon Liddy.
Yes, except that neither of us is a convicted felon.
Okay, but the general idea is strange bedfellows.
Yeah, that's right, Larry. Yeah. And then Newt and I got to talking, and before long we'd run out of things to talk about. And that's when the subject of education reform first came up.
Larry, do you realize that if you even have the slightest appreciation for what Deming and Drucker did to revolutionize management techniques, the American education system is an unmitigated disaster. Mm. And so before we can have a revolution in the classroom, We just absolutely have to have a revolution in the administration building.
And you see, Larry, this is where you can capture the differences in our backgrounds. Because at no school that I ever went to did they even have a whole administration building. So what we're doing is we're bringing together two different perspectives of a man who has stood at press conferences with Michael Jackson and a man who has stood in press conferences with Dick Armey. Yeah. This is really all about bridging differences and not about differentiating bridges.
Well, of course, the teacher's job is one of the hardest in all of show business, and which is to prevent revolution in the classroom, isn't it?
You know, it is. But, you know, Larry, and this is the fascinating thing. 20 years ago, Toffler said that in the future, the classroom will be more like a laboratory and vice versa. We're still not there yet.
The same thing they do now with the auditorium and the cafeteria.
That's right. And what Reverend Sharpton and I hope to bring to the table in our partnership is a shared conviction of the importance going forward of shared convictions within the context of a choice-centered matrix.
Reverend Sharpton, did you understand what your partner just said?
Larry, the speaker and I both believe that schools are just buildings. They're just bricks.
Except in California. You can't build with bricks out there.
Okay, but you can't reform the schools without reforming the people in the schools. That's why it's going to take a partnership between the right and the left, between a man who ran for president and a man who may be running for president, to build a nationwide consensus to at least come and hear what we've got to say in not like a town hall setting, but in, you know, something with reserved seating.
Yeah. Now, it says in your website, Mr. Speaker, that the two of you are taking this thing to Atlanta, Baltimore, and New Orleans. Why not New York? Why not Los Angeles? Best pastrami in the world at Nathan Allen's.
I have heard you saying that before, Larry, and I believe
it. No, you can ask Sean. She hears me say it all the time.
But those are just the first stops. Mm. And by the way, Reverend Sharpton and I, and the Secretary of Education, who's also lent his name to this effort, won't just be speaking. It's not just a speaking tour.
And it's not going to be like a Hillary Clinton listening tour, is it? Used to criticize that.
Nice try, Larry. But no, this is not a Hillary-style listening tour.
Okay.
We are, however, going to be signing at the end of every appearance, and that gives us a chance to get feedback from people who care enough about solving this problem to buy one of our books.
And it could be either one of our books, Larry. I mean, I'll sign his books. That's how tight we're getting with this thing.
Reverend, the Bush administration had its education reform with No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. What do you, Speaker Gingrich, want to accomplish with your reform?
Larry, I think what we're looking for might best be described as all children left ahead.
Larry, in fairness, we don't know the full dimensions of what that means yet.
But we do know that it can motivate a lot of folks to get up out of their easy chairs, turn off their TVs, and come out and get involved in the process of seeing us.
Mr. Speaker, just before we go, because Anderson Cooper's got a special series tonight on child prostitution in East St. Louis, Illinois, if you hadn't run into Reverend Sharpton in the airport, and I know this is a hypocritical question, who would you have wanted to partner with for this project?
Larry, I think if I hadn't had that chance encounter with a good reverend, I might well have just concentrated on promoting the futurist conservative agenda.
And the Reverend mentioned you might be running for president in 2012. Do you think your association with Al Sharpton might hurt your approval rating with the conservative Republican base?
Well, now, Larry, there are a few things more important than pandering to your base and the ability to completely re-engineer not only the optics, but also the metrics of the dysfunctional public school system in this country is just an opportunity that's too attractive to pass up.
Also, he is planning to airbrush me out of all the pictures on his website.
You're kidding, but he's going to do it. Speaker Newt Gingrich and Reverend Al Sharpton, wish we had more time. There's so much more I'd like to think about asking you. Tomorrow, for the full hour, Michael Jackson's Doctor's Nurse. Till then, from New York, good night.
longe que voa, brasa, chama na areia, bela, como eu queria, magra, leve e calma, toda ela bela, tudo nela chama, magra, leve e calma, toda ela bela, tudo nela chama.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, a special report. We're just about to join a live statement by Scottish Justice Minister Ken McCaskill. As you may know, a few days ago, it was Mr. McCaskill who released the convicted Lockerbie bomber on compassionate grounds. This is his first public statement since the storm of controversy that's resulted. And now, live from Glasgow, here's Mr. McCaskill.
There has been much discussion over the past few days about our policy of compassionate release as it is played out in one particular case. But we believe that living out the values of the Scottish nation don't depend on a particular case or particular circumstances. In a very real sense, they come with the territory. So, in the last few days, I've been dealing with a new appeal for compassionate release, an even more complicated one. In this case, the prisoner has again been duly charged and duly convicted with a heinous crime, the crime of murder. Once again, this person has shown no compassion to the victim of the crime, and we are being told by our critics that we should react accordingly to this appeal. In the new case, an additional complication is that we do not currently have this prisoner in our custody. In normal times, that fact alone would end our consideration. But in light of the recent controversy, I feel duty-bound to confront and disprove the charges that we have had some business or political motive in making decisions of this kind. Duty-bound to prove that our values apply in all kinds of cases, in all kinds of circumstances. The prisoner in this case, according to the specialists I've consulted, is not terminally ill, but those specialists have been unanimous in their conclusion that he is experiencing profound and continued mental anguish connected with the state-imposed loss of his hair, anguish that could very soon lead to self-destructive behaviour on the part of this prisoner. That is what I have been told by the people who know this case best. So I am using all the powers at my disposal, granting the request and requesting through proper diplomatic channels the compassionate release from California State Prison of Mr. Philip Spector, so he can live out the remainder of his years with whoever has custody of his wigs. May God bless us all. Thank you.
This has been a special report from CPR News. Funds came from the federal stimulus program's Public Radio Shovel Ready Fund. This is CPR Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Bozeman, Montana. Bozeman police officer has issued a formal apology to the city and its residents for content he posted on his Facebook page. Will they never learn? At a press conference, police officer Cody Anderson told his fellow officers he was sorry for portraying them in a negative light and apologized to everyone for writing such things as, quote, "I think there should be a law saying police can take people to jail for being stupid," on his Facebook page. His Facebook profile came into question after a civil lawsuit was filed against him, the city of Bozeman, and others. The lawsuit alleges Anderson wrongfully arrested a Bozeman man last February and states that entries from the cop's Facebook profile indicate the officer's lack of respect for citizens' rights. Sorry. But wait, there's more. Sarah Gilbert stepped off her bicycle long enough to send an angry tweet via Twitter, and it's changed the way one fast-growing burger chain treats bike riders. The 35-year-old blogger doesn't own a car. She gets around usually bike-friendly Portland, Oregon, on a custom-made bike, stretch bike that fits all three of her boys. But she biked last week into the drive-thru of the local Burgerville, an eco-conscious burger chain, and tried to order four cheeseburgers. She was refused service because she was ordering from a bike. She sent off a protest on Twitter. By the next day, Burgerville apologized. The Vancouver, Washington-based chain, with locations throughout the Northwest, has revamped its policy and will announce a new bicycle-friendly drive-thru program on September 8th. The same day this broadcast goes live to the city of New Orleans on WWNO-FM. Coincidentally, Dateline Chongqing, China, city mayor apologized to residents living near a smelter after hundreds of children were apparently poisoned by lead from the plant, prompting clashes between angry parents and police in recent days. The mayor of Baoji City in Shaanxi province arrived at the Dongling Lead and Zinc Smelting Company plant this week amid a protest by hundreds of villagers who tore down fences and blocked traffic. Mayor Dai apologized to residents for the poisoning and vowed the plant will not be allowed to open again until it meets health standards. Sorry about the poisoning. Really am. Dateline Fernley, Nevada. When President Bill Clinton's relationship with the White House intern erupted a decade ago, Nevada Senator John Ensign called for his resignation. But the Nevada Republican says that situation is different from the one he faces after admitting to an extramarital affair with a former campaign aide. Ensign says he didn't lie under oath like Clinton and he hasn't done anything legally wrong. He made the remarks before speaking to a Chamber of Commerce luncheon in rural Fernley, or Furl Rernley. The event was Ensign's first public appearance in his home state since acknowledging in June that he had an affair with his friend's wife, former campaign aide Cynthia Hampton. "I think it would be inappropriate to start any other way than to say I'm sorry," Ensign said. "I've said I'm sorry. I can't say I'm sorry enough. I made a big mistake in my life. And I apologize once again to all of you." I think he's sorry. The Fort Worth police chief apologized this week for a June 28th raid at the Rainbow Lounge that left one man seriously injured and civil rights activists outraged. The Fort Worth Police Department and Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission were accused of targeting the gay community and using excessive force in the raid. The incident happened on the anniversary of Stonewall, the 1969 New York City police raid that sparked riots leading to the gay rights movement. Said Fort Worth Police Chief Jeff Halstead, "The department's investigation is still underway," but he gave a preliminary briefing to the city council on today's progress report. "I am apologizing for the actions and the reflections that this gave our community. This resulted from flawed policy within the police department," unquote. I guess he means the beat the gays policy. I don't know. Maryland delegates John S. Cardin under fire for using Baltimore police officers. It's a police-filled apology week, ladies and gentlemen. for using Baltimore police officers in a staged marriage proposal, apologized this week to the police commissioner, who said he has ordered detectives to find out what resources were used, how they were used, and who was involved. He have offered an apology for putting the Baltimore Police Department in this kind of predicament and spotlight, said Police Commissioner Frederick Bielfield III. Cardin released a statement Monday that he was focused on his soon-to-be fiancée and could have used better judgment, did not return calls for comment. Deadline Cherry Hill, New Jersey. A contrite Christopher Christie, the Republican former prosecutor running for governor of New Jersey on a platform of corruption busting and ethical reform, apologized this week for failing to report a $46,000 loan to a top aide on his tax returns and financial disclosure forms. Quote, when I make mistakes, I'm going to admit them, he said, adding he'd already amended some of those filings and would finish the rest by Friday. Christie, who resigned last December as United States Attorney for New Jersey to challenge the governor, stood by his decision to lend the money to his subordinate, whom he promoted several months later. He won fame as a corruption fighter, trumpeting the indictments and convictions of scores of public officials. In New Jersey. Really? Corruption in New Jersey. By the way, I do have some black market kidneys that have come into my possession. But it was a somewhat humbled politician who spoke to reporters this week after the latest in a flurry of news reports that have left some scuffs on his reputation for rectitude, a key selling point in the state. To you and to the people of state, I'm going to tell you I'm not perfect and I'm not going to be. I'm going to make mistakes. And when I make mistakes, I'm going to own up to them. And this was a mistake and an oversight on his part, on my part. He didn't report the interest on the loan that he gave to his subordinate as income, you see, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that. Deadline Taipei, Formosa. Taiwan's top envoy to Japan was vacationing in Europe as the island he represents reeled from its worst weather disaster in half a century. John Feng, Taiwan's de facto ambassador to Japan, was traveling in Europe with his family while victims of killer Typhoon Morakot were awaiting international aid in Taiwan. He has now apologized for his absence in a statement released by Taipei's representative office in Tokyo. Sorry I wasn't there. Be their next disaster. In Columbia, nearby Columbia, South Carolina, Fairfield County School District officials have apologized to the mother of a three-year-old girl after the woman says her child was left unattended on a school bus. District officials said they are looking into why the three-year-old was left on a school bus. The district apologized but says the child wasn't on the bus for, quote, any length of time, unquote. Only 2 weeks after a flight sat idle on a Minnesota tarmac for almost 6 hours, more than 100 Sun Country passengers in New York Friday waited that long for their Twin Cities-bound plane to take off. The wait went on, said one passenger. We just didn't have any communication. There was no presence from the staff saying this was what the deal was. Everybody was getting a little anxious. So Sun Country Airlines has apologized. It just leaves United to apologize for me. Never mind. Dateline Tripoli, Swiss President Hans Rudolf Merz apologized to the Libyan people on Thursday over the arrest in Geneva a year ago of a son of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. I expressed to the Libyan people my apologies for the unjust arrest of Libyan diplomats by Geneva police, he said. Probably not the best timing for doing that. And it's very clear that Whole Foods CEO John Mackey's piece in the Wall Street Journal, an opinion piece against the Obama health care plan, offended some of our customers, says a statement by Whole Foods. We offer you our sincere apology. And it's organic. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. finally, ladies and gentlemen, what kind of people become life coaches? Have you ever wondered? Well, here's one. Jason Blair, the ex-journalist best known for foisting plagiarism and fabrication into the pages of the New York Times, has now embarked on his new career, a life coach. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. Shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone at Stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/LeShow. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like President Obama reading up before he does an exclusive interview with a New Orleans newspaper, if you'd agree to join with me then. All righty. Thank you very much. Address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on just two of the features always available at harryshearer.com. I would check out my post in this week's Huffington Post for more on President Obama and New Orleans. Word to the wise. And thanks as always to Pam Halstead and all the desks for helping to make today's program possible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.